Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Michelle Martin, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Kids today are busy. Most people agree on that. They've got long days of school, and even in the summer, tutoring and sports practices or a part-time job can last well into the evening. But what about the days when summer, for Americans of certain backgrounds anyway, meant camp? And camp meant toasting marshmallows around a campfire, swimming in the lake, and writing letters, not texts, to mom and dad. This hour, On Point, what happened to summer camp? You can join us on air or online. Did you go away to camp? Did you love it? Or would you not wish it on your worst enemy? We'd love to hear your memories. Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'd like to start by finding out more about the history of summer camp in the U.S. So joining us now from Vancouver, Canada, is Leslie Paris. She's an historian of American childhood and a professor of American history at the University of British Columbia. She's also the author of Children's Nature, The Rise of the American Summer Camp. Leslie Paris, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Michelle. Thanks for having me.
Did you go to camp?
Yes, I did. I went to several.
You went to several? Sleepaway camp with marshmallows and the campfire and all that? Okay, very good.
I certainly did.
We're on firm ground here because I will disclose up front, I have never been to camp. And so this is all new territory to me. So I'd love to ask you, how did summer camp start? What was the idea?
Well, in the late 19th century, some middle and upper class men got the idea to take small groups of boys camping. They were motivated by a few different things. One was anxieties about the modern age. Cities were getting bigger, and many of these men worried that the lives of boys whom they imagined were going to rule the United States when they grew up, so elite boys, were getting softer, that American culture was too soft, and that boys needed to be toughened up, having a dose of outdoor adventure away from the cities, that urban life was not as healthy as rural life, and that boys would benefit in all kinds of ways from being away from their mothers and away from modern entertainment. So in some ways, their interests were similar to those of some summer camp proponents today. Many of them were also muscular Christians. They believed that in a more virile form of Christianity, you could think of Theodore Roosevelt as an example of a muscular Christian. And they were also motivated by new ideas that young people deserve to have a protected childhood.
So what did they do? So all of the things that we associate with kind of camp, with camp, date back to those very early camps. I mean, the kind of a lot of outdoor time, you know, canoeing and swimming and kind of rustic.
Absolutely.
That's from the very beginning.
If I could take you in a time machine right now to Squam Lake in New Hampshire in 1881, you would see many of the same activities that are done at camps today. The children at Camp Chocorua, one of the first boys' camps, which was running from 1881 to 1889, played baseball, went fishing, had water sports days, pillow fights, went on a long hike of several days away from camp, worked toward a camp medal, went swimming, all of these things.
So originally this was for wealthy boys, but girls eventually got in on the act. And apparently also, I think a lot of people understand that there are ethnic camps with, you know, very long traditions as well, like, you know, camps for Jewish kids and camps with kids from different immigrant backgrounds and also camps for low-income kids. When did those start happening?
By the end of the 19th century, there were a small number of private camps for girls that had been founded by women who themselves had gone to university and wanted girls to have the kinds of opportunities that they themselves had not had in their girlhood. A number of settlement houses of the period, today we might consider them community centers, founded camps for immigrant children, mostly from Europe, whom they were interested in Americanizing and bringing to camp for healthy outdoor adventures. And from the 1880s onward, the YMCA movement, and then later in the 19-teens, the Boy Scouts, the Girl Scouts, and the Campfire Girls all founded camps for kids as well. So by the turn of the century, but especially in the 19-teens and 20s, there was a much wider range of camps serving a much wider range of children. Jewish camping is a good example of this trend. Most camps run by Christians were for Christians only. Jewish camp owners started a parallel track of camping for Jewish children.
So was this a situation where, like, technology, for example, certain people get it first, and then they're the early adopters, and then other people think that has benefits too, let's do that also?
That's exactly what happened. Sometimes they had slightly different interests. Those who started girls' camps, for example, wanted to give girls opportunities that they might well not have in the city. Those who took immigrant children into the woods also hoped to make them more American. However, the fundamental idea that camp was a place of health, of community, of learning, of adventure, and of pleasure was true for all kinds of camps.
Now, one thing I noticed that just looking at where a lot of the early camps were, they all seem to be on the East Coast. Do I have that right? Is this primarily an East Coast phenomenon? And if so, why is that?
It wasn't exclusively an East Coast phenomenon in its early years, but it was primarily an East Coast phenomenon, mostly because that's where the biggest cities were. And parents tended to be more eager to send their kids away if they lived in some of these larger cities. So if you look at cities around the country, there's an example of a camp serving Seattle children, at least as early as the early 1890s. There were YMCA camps across the country by this period. However, nowhere was the camp industry denser and more innovative and more diverse than in the Northeast, especially in the New York City area, at camps that were a day's distance of New York.
Speaking of the camp industry, I'm interested in how that has changed over the years. So, Leslie, I hope you'll stay with us. And also, I'd like to bring now Brooke Salkoff to join us. She's the founder of CampEasy.com. That's a website that helps parents and kids find camps that fit their needs. Brooke Salkoff, welcome to On Point. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Michelle. Thanks for having me.
What have you noticed? Well, first of all, how long has your website, your company been in existence?
Right. So we rolled out about 3 years ago, and we serve parents. We have searches in every state for parents who are looking for camps. But of course, our definition of camps is a little bit broader than what you're talking about, and I think that's an interesting part of the conversation.
Sure. Yeah, I want to hear about
the new view of camps.
Mm-hmm. I want to hear about that. But how does your site work? You're kind of a matchmaker, correct?
Right. Exactly. Well, we started. Off, I come from the perspective of a working parent. I've been in the news business my whole life as a correspondent for NBC News. So I'm sort of like you, sifting through a lot of information every day as a sort of professional mission. But I found myself just tearing my hair out year after year, finding and planning camps for my kids, even when I was living in this information sort of tsunami. And it was very challenging for me, not just for me, but for other working parents that I came into contact with. And the fact is, those working families are 4 out of 5 families in the United States have 2 incomes. And so for those parents, finding camp opportunities where their kids are in safe and supervised settings in the summertime when they're not in school, doing constructive things, I mean, that's the vast majority of Americans out there who are looking for these activities for their kids when they're not in school.
So you need something to do when the kids aren't in school. So how it works is what the camps pay you, and then you...
Exactly,
the parents
yes.
can, and then the parents use you as a resource.
Exactly, right. Yeah. We're free to parents, and then camps pay us for enhanced visibility on the site. And we're also capturing all of the market trends online. So how parents are searching for camps, when they're looking, what kinds of camps they're looking for. We want to give camps as much information as possible so that they can make better decisions about their programming and how they market themselves.
Well, give us some of that information. What are the trends now? Is that summer sleepaway experience, is that a very small part of the landscape now? Is it still a big part of the landscape now?
It ends up being just a sliver of the whole camp universe, mostly because a lot of businesses that haven't really been geared themselves toward camps have gotten into the camp business. So you'll see martial arts studios, for instance, offering camp programs in the summertime, or ballet studios, and they're calling themselves camps. Google just yesterday offered a camp to kids. Now, that one is exclusively online, so that doesn't even qualify under my definition of camp, which is really just an extended learning experience. But there are programs even for adults that call themselves camps. So by some people's definition, camp basically goes right up to senior living, and it's an extended learning experience for all generations. So, we really focus on the extended learning experiences for kids.
So you're saying schools now that will open a camp in the summer.
Exactly. You know. And I'll tell you, the independent schools and private schools that operate in urban environments, they have significant marketing budgets, and they are promoting their camp programs in the summertime heavily, really as extensions of their marketing department, so that they can get kids on campus familiar with their staff and their programming and, you know, as part of their recruitment for fall registrations.
Brooks, just briefly, if you would, because we need to take your short break in a minute, and I hope you'll stay with us along with Professor Paris. But you know, the trend kind of away from the sleepaway for the summer experience, is that the cost, or is that kind of lifestyle changes? Because, you know, might think with, as you just mentioned, there are two working parents is now the norm in families that have two working parents. You could think they might more easily afford it, but perhaps with both parents working, they don't want their kids away from them that long. And they think, you know, I see my kid at night. I don't want to lose them for the summer. What do you think is the more relevant factor in driving this change?
Right. Well, if you think of this as a marketplace with buyers and sellers, where parents are the buyers and the camps are the sellers, the sellers are really adjusting to factors now on buyers, which are the working families. So in the same way that we're seeing this yawning income gap in America, you have the 1%, and certainly there are camps that are catering toward 1%. I've met parents who spend $25,000 a summer on camp. Most camps are really having to adjust to the forces now on working families, the 99%. Where you have parents with two incomes who have no time, and so they need opportunities for their kids, and they're looking for constructive activities for them. And they're spending $25 billion a year on camp. That's more than they spend on airfare. So this is a huge and underserved market.
Well, I hope you'll stay with us and tell us more of these fascinating details. We're talking summer camp. It's a tradition as American as apple pie. I'm Michelle Martin, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Michelle Martin, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking summer camp, and you hear the 1995 film It Takes Two. And, of course, a food fight breaks out in the dining hall of Camp Callaway. Always wanted to do that. Not going to do that in my living room. You can join the conversation. Do you send your kids to summer camp? Why? Would you never send your kids to summer camp? Why not? With us is Leslie Paris, author of Children's Nature, The Rise of the American Summer Camp, and Brooke Salkoff, founder of CampEasy.com. She's a matchmaker. She helps parents and kids find the right camp for their families. Thanks so much for staying with us. You know, I'm just in playing that clip, they're reminded that camp seems to have a very special place in American pop culture. I just want to play a clip from the classic 1979 film Meatballs.
Attention all campers, afternoon swim schedule is as follows. Advanced dolphins will report to the dock for survival swimming and IQ testing. All senior silverfish meet on the beach for nude sunbathing. Junior salmon, trout, and herring report to the nearest delicatessen. Six-year-old tadpoles report to the swamp. And all lobsters, get out of here, you're a menace.
That makes it sound like so fun. Leslie, why do you think that is, that there have been so many movies with camp as a central experience?
By the 1940s and onward, American camps had become part of American popular culture. Whether or not individual children went to them, everybody knew about them. And they were known for being places of fun. Part of why camps were successful was not only because adults promoted them, but because kids enjoyed them. And if you talk to people who went to summer camps, many of them will say that their best memories are about the crazy pranks that they took part in and the intense friendships they had, the special code words, the songs, the things that made their community feel special and different. And I think that movies like Meatballs they appreciate these playful parts of the camp experience.
Let's hear some listeners about that. They're calling in with their memories. Darren is calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Darren. Do you have a memory of camp?
Yes, Michelle. I just really wanted to say thanks for bringing up this subject, because I was just driving, running errands for work, and you guys were talking about this, and it just, my mind just flooded back to, I'm in Nashville now, but I went to a camp. It was called Camp Wakanda in Washington, Maine, about 6 years in a row when I was real young. And it's probably some of the best memories of my entire childhood. I mean, it's the only time and only place where it's like the first day of school when you show up, because you don't know anyone really. And then by, 6 days later, you're wanting to cry because you're missing your best friends. And it was just the camaraderie. And I think back now and just some of the topics that, I'm sorry, I don't know her name. I can't remember it. But anyway, the insurance, what it would cost now. I mean, we were canoeing. We were shooting pellet guns. We were, archery. I mean, there was all these things, and I never even thought about it. It was so much fun. There was so many things to do. I still remember it was a Christian-based camp, and we used to have a prayer a blessing song that we had to sing. I still remember it to this day, and I was probably 10 years old. I'm 40 years old now. And I really, I feel bad for if children aren't allowed to do that, or they just, it's kind of moved on. I don't think that'll ever happen again.
Can you sing the blessing song? Sing a little of the blessing song for me.
Bless our friends, bless our food, bless us all forever. Yeah, I remember.
You sure can. You sure can. What do you think it did for you, Darren? Yeah. Why do you think it looms so large in your life as a good memory?
Well, we were poor growing up, and I actually, the church chipped in so my brothers and sister could go with us, and my father died when I was real young. So it was a camaraderie with, my camp counselor. I can't remember his name, but I remember his face. I remember just thinking, wow, this guy's like my hero, because he knew all these things about the Maine woods and how to, make a snare. And you're just, I probably had 3 girlfriends in 7 days. You know what I mean?
Oh, dear. Well, that'll do anything for anybody's confidence. Well, thank you, Darren. I appreciate it. Thank you for calling. Let's hear from Liz, who's calling from Miami, Florida. Liz, did you go to camp, and what's your memory?
Hi, Michelle. Thanks for having me. Yes, in fact, I did go to camp. I was very fortunate because I didn't grow up in this country, and my parents were very sort of forward-thinking and sent me to camp in New York, upstate New York, and it was the most amazing experience. So when I had my kids, I said, definitely, they're going to be camp kids, and they were. We started them off at about 10, going up to Maine every year for 6 weeks, and they absolutely loved it, and it changed their lives.
Was it a financial strain, if you don't mind my asking? Was it something that was a priority that you budgeted for, or did it just fit into your budget?
No, we budgeted for it for 10 years. I married somebody who had never been to camp and sort of didn't understand why I was so enthusiastic about it, but I sort of convinced him to budget for it for all those years. And once our daughter came back that first summer, she was such a different person. She was so independent. She had learned great new skills like sailing and all kinds of neat things. And he was blown away. And he said, absolutely, this is worth every penny. And then we continued to do it for years.
What, how many pennies, if you don't mind my asking?
It was about $5,000 for each child. So I have 2 children. So it was about $10,000 a summer. But we were both working parents. And, my kids were products of technology, just like every kid is now. So all about the cell phones and the this and the that. And this camp that I chose in upstate Maine, you had to check the technology at the door. So it was completely, old fashioned, rural, living in a bunk, no cell phones, no iPods, no anything. For 6 weeks of just nature and fun. And it was so healthy for my children.
Oh, thank you for calling. How about Karen, who's calling from Bowling Green, Kentucky? Karen, thanks so much for joining us as well. Do you have memories you want to tell us about?
Well, I have great memories, but, the one thing I want to say is that to parents who are, considering this, I just think camp is a life-changing experience, or it was for my 3 children. I have 3 kids, and they've all gone to camp. In fact, they've already been this year. I think the whole camp experience provides them an opportunity for independence. It gives them a chance to get away from electronics. It gives them a chance to meet kids from other communities that they might not otherwise meet. And it gives them an opportunity to do other things outside of our community. They get to go canoeing, whitewater rafting, fireside devotions, things like that. So it's been a great experience for our family.
Oh, Karen, thanks so much for joining us. You know, we've been hearing some wonderful memories, but I do think it's important to point out that not every person who goes to camp loves it. In fact, I have a letter here that one of my colleagues founded, a postcard that she sent home a few years ago. I won't tell you how many years ago. And it reads as follows. Dear Mommy and Daddy, on visiting day, please bring M&Ms, not peanut, Reese peanut butter cups, black licorice, Hawaiian punch, bubble gum, snow caps, and Mimi's chocolate chip cookies. Love, Cass. P.S. I hate it here. And that's our executive producer, Karen Schiffman, whose mother still saved the postcard she sent home from camp. So, Brooke, I'm going to ask you about this. Why is it that, you know, you hear about this every time, you know, you do a story like this. And in fact, we even have some calls to this effect that some people just hate it. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think that that initial separation from the creature comforts and your parents, I think it can be harsh on some kids. But for those who keep going back, I think, as the callers have noted, that sense of independence, that ability to make new friends and get by without those creature comforts, I think it can be life-changing. What you talked about and just how people remember camp and its transformative effect on what they go on to do. My own husband, who went to camp, he was from New York, went to camp in Connecticut. That's where he learned to use a bow and arrow, where he learned to sail and water ski. He says he wouldn't have gone to the Naval Academy had it not been for camp. And you look at folks like Michael Eisner, the former CEO of Disney, who credits a lot of his interests and later success to his experience at camp. You know, Duck Dynasty, I saw the other night, one of the characters on that show, one of the guys on that show met his wife at camp. And you hear these stories over and over again. Adam Levine of Maroon 5 credits camp. Neil Patrick Harris credits camp. Kevin Systrom, the founder of Instagram, says he learned Photoshop at a summer camp.
Let me just play one more clip. Go to one more caller. Anne from Madison, Wisconsin. I'm not sure she loved it either. And I'm interested to hear about her experience. And do I have that right, that you did not love it?
No, I did. I did love camp. I did not love the time leading up to camp because I was around 10 or 11 years old. And at that time, I had problems with wetting the bed. And I had just learned about menstruation.
So you were scared to go away?
I was terrified for months leading up to camp. I was so afraid that I would have an accident or I would get my period or some other terrible thing was going to happen. And I don't remember talking to anyone about it. It was just something I carried around with me. And then I went to camp and I didn't have any problems. And yet I really enjoyed dorm life. It was the first time I ever saw a naked woman, which might sound funny, but I never had. So that was unusual. And, I made friends that I still keep in touch with on Facebook now.
That's great.
So, yeah, it was a fun thing.
All right. Well, that's great. Well, thanks so much for calling us. And thanks for being honest about what had to have been kind of an embarrassing period in your life. But that's like being a kid is about being embarrassed, isn't it? I mean, like, that's like, isn't like that like your major memory? Brooke, tell us about one of the things that that I think you were telling us about is that the range of offerings has really exploded in recent years. The kinds of things that you can do at camp, whether it's sleepaway or day camp, has really exploded. Can you tell us a little bit about that and why is that?
Right, absolutely. So the specialization of these camps really affects what you're seeing even closer to home in that increased focus on specialized sports at an early age. So now, instead of just going to baseball camp, you can go to shortstop camp or third baseman's camp or midfielder's camp for soccer or lacrosse. You do see that specialization. And also, another big force on parents and camps now is that camp sessions are becoming shorter and shorter, and that's really to accommodate this search by parents to basically fill the holes in their summer weeks that they need to have plans and coverage for their kids. So it's sort of, for the parents, it's like solving this three-dimensional Sudoku puzzle, because now all of a sudden you have all kinds of options that you're trying to piece together, especially for multiple kids. That can become really, really challenging. So these shorter sessions and increased specialization is a challenge on both sides.
Let's hear from somebody who's involved in that. Joining us now from Vancouver is Jean McDonald, who started one of those specialty camps that you've been telling us about. Her camp is called App Camp for Girls. It's a week-long camp where girls design and build apps. Jean, thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, Michelle.
And I guess we're not pulling you away from a weenie roast, but from definitely apps. So thank you so much for joining us. Where did this idea come from?
I work in the software industry, which, as many people know, is quite male-dominated. And I just felt like I got to do something. Girls can definitely write software. Girls use iPhones. Women use iPhones. Why aren't we writing more of the apps and getting into this side of, you know, the economy? And so I had a lot of experience with camp myself. I was a volunteer at a program called Rock and Roll Camp for Girls in Portland, which is pretty amazing, where girls come in and they learn an instrument and they join a band and they write a song and they play a showcase at the end of the week. And I saw like how that changed their attitude towards something that they may have perceived was really a boy-oriented activity, rock and roll, to something that they themselves could do, and especially with an all-female team of women mentors. And so I thought, could we do something like that for software? And that's where the idea for App Camp for Girls came from.
Who finds their way to you? Are there people, are the parents people who are already involved in the industry as you are, or are they people who are not at all involved and want their kids to be involved? Who's driving this train, by the way? Do you find, is it the girls who are driving the train to come to your camp, or is it their parents who want them to have exposure to this?
Well, I think it's a mix. I know that every session, you know, the girls fill out surveys about what they liked and what they didn't like, and I frequently get a comment of, my mom made me come to this camp, I didn't realize it would be so much fun, because we do make it fun. It's not like school at all. And
hey, school can be fun. A lot of teachers listening. Step
I'm
light
sorry,
there.
I didn't mean to do school. I just, but you know, we don't. We don't consider, you know, we do a lot of kinds of activities, not just sitting in front of computers. We have hula hooping class and we have yoga class, and the girls get to go on a field trip and things like that. So it's, not just sitting in front of a computer all day, which, you know, we feel like they get enough of that the rest of the year. So,
thank you.
But yeah, I think right now with the camp, just getting, we launched in 2013 and we're pretty well known in our, like, segment of Apple-oriented developers and geeks. And so a lot of the girls do come from a background where their parents are software engineers or work in the software business. But we are reaching out to reach the girls who wouldn't normally hear about it, say on Twitter, which tends to be pretty geek-oriented.
Well, thank you. Jean McDonald is the founder of App Camp for Girls. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Brooke, just the minute we have left before we need to take a break, do you find that people are increasingly starting the kinds of camps that they wish they had attended?
Well, yeah, and just like App Camp for Girls, I think a lot of these new camps are there in order to supplement some education that kids are not getting in school. And so that's a big interest among parents. In fact, academic enrichment camps are really, really growing in interest. They're one of the most popular categories on Camp Easy.
But just very briefly before we let you go, you heard Professor Paris tell us that, you know, in an earlier era, there was a lot of interest in having kids from backgrounds where the parents didn't have a lot of money and giving them access to these kinds of opportunities. Is there still that movement, or is this generally the kind of thing that you can participate in if you can afford it?
Absolutely. No, there are nonprofit camps out there. In fact, a lot of the Y camps, Boy Scout camps, and Girl Scout camps are geared toward folks who just want these experiences for their kids and have tiered pricing and financial aid or camperships for kids in order to make sure that those kids have access to the camp experience too. So this is really a tremendous market to work in. I mean, the people who are running these camps are not doing it because of the glamour, lack of glamour. They're not doing it for the money. They really just want to provide these experiences with kids because they know, they've lived it for years and years, how transformative and formative those experiences are for kids, and they want to continue that tradition.
Brooke Salikoff is the founder of CampEasy.com. She's a matchmaker to match families with the right camp. Brooke, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Michelle.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at WBUR.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes.
This is On Point. I'm Michelle Martin, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about summer camp. We're talking about what we may have learned as adults if we went, what we hope our kids will learn if they go. Here's Alan Sherman's hit song about summer camp from 1963.
Hello, mother. Hello, father. Here I am at Camp Granada. Camp is very entertaining. And they say we'll have some fun if it stops raining.
I'm not going to lie to you. I just wanted to play that song. That's as close as I ever got to camp when I was growing up. So that's the only thing I know. I know that song. You can join the conversation. Parents, did you go to overnight camp? Did you love it? Did you hate it? Do you send your children to the same camp? With me is Leslie Paris, author of Children's Nature, The Rise of the American Summer Camp. Leslie, I'm telling you, I'm getting so many reach outs from people on Facebook, on Twitter, who are telling us that I would not be who I am if I did not go to camp. I just want to play. I just want to read one of them. This is from Wendy Fischow Dolan, who reached out to us from Facebook. And she says, I grew up in a small town near New Orleans. Almost everyone I know was white and Catholic. When I was about 8 years old, my wonderful late grandma got a job as a camp nurse at a predominantly Jewish girls' camp in Maine and brought me along in lieu of payment. That experience changed my life. I learned what it meant to be a minority, met kids and counselors from all over the world, and was exposed to diverse cultures for the first time. And we have another listener who wrote in saying, I love it. I try to be a counselor at a Ukrainian scouting camp whenever I can. It's wonderful to get outside of the office and be one with nature. And but here's another one. Vikara from Twitter found us from Twitter and said, I found my letters from camp cleaning out parents' house. They all say, please come get me. Much sacrifice for me. Hated it. Leslie, what do you think about that? It's interesting. Is it? Do you find that there's this really stark dividing line?
I would say that most kids who went to camp really enjoyed themselves, but some really did hate it. Some of the best letters that I read when I was doing my archival research for the book were letters from very unhappy campers, not because they were unhappy, but because they were such wonderful letters, children threatening to run away from the camp and get home on their very own. The flip side of this, of course, is that parents were often homesick for their children. For many parents, it was the first time they were separated from their kids. Some parents loved it, loved the autonomy that they could have or the time to organize their lives differently, especially if both parents were working, although that was less common in this earlier period that I look at. But other parents felt really lonesome and missed their children a lot.
What about the whole physical labor aspect of it? What about the fact that a lot of people, I don't know if they still do this, were expected to really participate in the running of the camp, you know, helping to grow the vegetables, even slaughtering the animals. Does that still go on? And what about that?
I think there are very few camps where children slaughtered the animals historically, but there are a lot of camps where children did some kind of service to the camp, whether that was peeling potatoes, keeping the grounds clean. Being part of the maintenance of the camp has been a way for children to take ownership of their camp experience. And sometimes former campers told me that those kinds of chores are among their most treasured memories of autonomy, independence, and a sense that they too were contributing.
Let's go to a caller who I think may have an experience about like that. This is Jill, and she's calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Jill, did you have an experience like that?
Michelle, it's wonderful to hear your voice. Yes, I did. I went to a camp in Western North Carolina buried in the Smokies in the 50s. It was called High Valley Camp, and it was actually a farm. And we grew our own food, and at the end of the summer, we did slaughter our own animals and ate them the following year. And it was an interesting mix of kids, for the most part, Jewish sort of left-leaning kids from New York who came to the camp through the owner and director who was at Columbia Teachers College, but counselors from the South, deep South, and some from the little valley that we were in called the Crusoe Valley, some of whom had never been out of that valley. And the valley was something you could walk the length of in not too long a period of time. And I met my best friend there, and she and I went back a couple summers ago. We want to try and put together a book, at least of our memories, if not of something more substantial. And we talked to one of the people who's still alive, and we asked him what he really thought about us. And we used to get in the trucks. They would take us to go pick peaches, and we'd sing civil rights songs in the Deep South in the early 60s and late 50s. The fact that we did get killed was just a testimony to how carefully those Southern counselors took care of us. But one of them said, we asked him how he thought of us, and he said, we were actually grateful to you because at the end of the summer, we could go under the bunk. We would sweep through the big holes that were in the wide board floors. We would go under there, and we would find enough pencils to take us through the school year. I mean, we had no idea about the crushing poverty that these people lived in. We just, kind of, to tell you the truth, didn't we didn't have as high an opinion of them as they had of us, it turned out. It was a sobering few days when we were back there recently. It was an amazing place.
What effect do you think it had on you, Jill?
Well, I'm a documentary photographer documenting rural America. So
there it is.
There it is.
Set the cost of you off. Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for sharing that memory. We wanted to hear from somebody who's involved in one of these kind of traditional camps that we were talking about earlier, that our earlier guest was telling us that is not as attractive to many parents as it used to be, or that there are so many other alternatives that they're moving away from that. And that is Mickey Black from Greeley, Pennsylvania. He's a third generation owner and director of the Pine Forest Camp, which is in the heart of the Poconos. Mickey Black, thanks so much for joining us.
Hello from camp, Michelle.
What did I take you away from?
Well, let's see. We just had a group leaving to play another camp in soccer, so you probably heard the bus honking its horn and cheering as it left.
Okay. All right. That sounds like fun.
On the grounded camp.
Well, tell us about the history of the camp. Three generations, family-owned. How did that start?
Yes, my grandfather started the camps in the time of the Depression in 1931 and tracks an arc that Leslie described of a lot of American families. He was an immigrant. He came from Russia. He was a professional basketball player. In those days, there were ethnic basketball teams, and so he had an all-Jewish team from Philadelphia. He became a teacher. He started the camp. And then my dad grew up here, went off to World War II, came back. I was here in the 60s, you know, the year of Vietnam and Woodstock, and my children now are involved, and technology has evolved, and it's really, you know, we've had challenges along the way, but we have held true to our core values and are going strong. And I really do think camps like ours are having a resurgence now. I think that although there is a place for these specialty camps, traditional, solid, well-run camps are strong and going strong and having really a resurgence, especially as children have this plugged-in world. I think those core values, the authenticity of a traditional camp has even more impact.
What are the core values, by the way? Was there a kind of a founding principle or idea that your grandfather had when he was founding the camp? What is it?
Well, I think that it was to create a community where children were safe and happy and had fun. They could make friends and they could find adventure. And I think those are still true. I mean, we just make sure that every child finds success here. And, you know, we see, although camp has become much more sophisticated and diverse in a lot of ways, it's still campfires and traditional games, goofy skits, those kinds of old rituals, candlelight ceremonies that really are the magic of camp. And I find those very compelling. So it's really the same songs we sang then, the same rituals we did have even more impact.
What's the biggest change, though, you've seen over time? Are the kids different or are the parents different? I know you offer a lot more activities than you used to. You were telling us that.
Yeah.
There are many more choices. Choice time has a lot more choices during the day. But what's the biggest change you've seen?
Yes. Well, there are more choices. I think there are, you know, in the old days, there were maybe 20 different activities. Now there are over 40, 50. I think the level of instruction has been raised. Our facilities are much more sophisticated. You know, we have the latest in everything. But I find that what keeps families coming back and what really is the compelling part of camp are sort of being with friends, having adventure, doing those things that are sort of core values. It's sort of a yearning for that old-fashioned nostalgia of camp. And that is really what's making camp like ours more popular than ever. These are good times for traditional camps like ours.
Is it? And are these good times because you've got repeat visitors, like customers or families coming from the same family coming back generation after generation just like yours? Or are you finding a new group of people discovering the camp experience?
Both. I think that there are families who grew up with this, but we also are finding families who want their children to build these sort of strength of character qualities, you know, optimism, enthusiasm, getting along with others. These are things that we camp is all about. You know, you can't teach those things really to your children at home. You can send them to good schools. You can take them on trips. But the things we do here really are discovering those inner core strength of character elements that make you a good person. And I think those things are still as relevant as ever. But yes, camp is much more diverse, much more complicated. You know, our menu is more diverse. Our activities are more diverse.
Is your clientele more diverse?
And our clientele is more diverse.
Is it in fact more diverse?
It is. It is.
So
children from different parts of the country, even children from other countries who are coming to traditional camps, they hear about this American experience. And so we have included children from other countries, other cultures into our camp community. And it's made it more interesting and more exciting.
Let's hear from some more callers. Mike is calling from Hollywood, Florida. Mike, what would you like to say to add to this?
Hi, Michelle. Yes, I'd just like to add to what the last caller mentioned about the strength of character, the rite of passage that is so often missing in our culture today. And unfortunately, it would only be available to those who can afford to go to a camp. This camp sounds wonderful, but it's just not accessible to everybody. I'd like to speak about my experience where I worked for free at a nonprofit in Washington State. It's called the North Cascades Institute and their program Mountain School, where it's a very much summer camp-like experience, but for every single student in the public school system, it gets them out into nature, they set up their own camp spot, they learn about nature in nature. It's experiential education, and it's provided free as part of the school system there. And I think this is something that should be brought far and wide.
Oh, thank you.
We need these experiences for kids. I'm sorry you didn't get to have this experience.
I was going to say, can I go? I guess it's too late for me to go into the North Spaces and hang out.
We worked with fifth graders and also seventh graders. They came with their regular teachers, and I worked as an adjunct environmental educator. And this could be done everywhere. We happen to work in an old-growth forest in Washington State, and these were inner-city kids from Seattle who never got to experience this.
That's lovely.
It was fabulous. And
that sounds
I'd love to see it everywhere.
Thanks for calling, Mike. What about Teddy, who's calling from Dothan, Alabama? Teddy, do you have a memory of camp that you wanted to share?
Yes, ma'am. It's Cody, by the way.
Okay. Say it again, please.
I was. Just,
it's Cody?
It's Cody, by the way.
Cody, thank you so much for correcting me.
Yes, ma'am. Yeah. I just wanted to tell you about some memories from camp that kind of shaped me as a person. I am a gay man who was born and raised in southeastern Alabama in the middle of the Bible Belt, and I went to church camp every year throughout my high school career. And one year, I fell for a guy. And it was a combination of the lack of social contracts and niceties that are in day-to-day life and me being expected to think for myself and the lack of distractions that you have back at home that kind of made me have this existential moment and helped me learn to accept who I am as a person and shaped me today.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you for that. I appreciate it. Thank you for calling. The couple of minutes that we have left, Mickey, I wanted to ask you, we were talking about what it is that kind of shapes people's decisions around camp these days? You know, you might think with two working parents, people might have more disposable income. Certainly some people do. But do you find that there are cultural reasons that do people think that they're bad parents if they send their kids away for 3 weeks or 6 weeks? Do you find that to be a hurdle as well?
Well, I do think that there are families who have had this in their camp, their family for years, and it was just a tradition to go off to camp. And I do think that for some parents, it is shocking to think that you could send your children away for that long, for 7 weeks. But when they can make that leap of faith, it goes fast, and they are so proud of their children when they come home, and it really gives the child a sense of independence and self-confidence and self-esteem that I just don't believe you can get pretty much anywhere else. But yes, it is a leap of faith, but parents see it in others. They want this quality. They want their children to have these characteristics, and they make the leap of faith. And
the financial sacrifice. Mickey, look, quick question for you. Why do you stay in it? I understand that you're trained as a lawyer, so you obviously could be doing something else. Why do you stay in it? Why have you stayed in it all these years?
Well, I love it, and to me, it's part of our core. I mean, you know, I was never in business. I always grew up in a camp family, and my children did. And for us, this is just a lifestyle. It's something we believe in. My wife runs the kitchen. My son and daughter are very active. My son's named after camp. His middle name is Forrest, and I have a granddaughter, Hattie, who's named after Yui, our founder. We are all about camp.
You're all about camp.
We are all about it. We are in 100%, all in. And it's what we do. It's what we believe in. It goes to the core, our heart and soul, and the heart and soul of camp. So, yes, we are fully involved, and I think that's one of the things that makes us a great camp, I like to think.
All right. Mickey Black is a third generation owner and director of the Pine Forest Camp that's in the Poconos. Mickey, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you. Have a great summer.
All right. Thank you. Unless we only have a minute left. Do you think that 5 years from now, will we still be talking about this? Do you think camp will still be? Will we still have people calling up to say, it changed my life?
Absolutely. Without a doubt, it's been a very important, sometimes transformational experience for generations of campers.
All right. Leslie Paris is a professor of American history at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. She's the author of Children's Nature, The Rise of the American Summer Camp. Leslie, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Hope you get some s'mores later today. Think of us when you do. You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up tomorrow, South Carolina votes on whether to take down the Confederate flag. Is this a new day in the South? I'm Michelle Martin, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.